Jesus was not a great man. At least that's what the Romans would say. John Ortberg describes what it looked like to be great in the Roman Empire, a large part of which was your status, your class, your level of importance. How high up the social ladder you were really mattered back then. Cicero wrote, quote, rank must be preserved. Aristotle wrote that the great-souled man is extremely proud. So great people would disdain praise from the common people, and they indulged in conspicuous consumption. Aristotle said, the great like to own beautiful and useless things, since those are better marks of their independence. Imagine a world based on status. It's easy if you try. The Roman Empire was kind of set up like most airlines are today, with a big gap between customers who are first class and those who are just coach, and never the twain shall meet. Airlines work hard to reinforce the chasm between the two. First class people get to board first, because they're first class people. They get to walk through a separate gate that has a red carpet that we're not allowed to walk on. They sit near the front of the plane. They eat on fine china and drink free wine. It's kind of like the airlines are trying to replicate our junior high experience, where a select few were envied by all of the rest. People in Jesus' day were also divided into two groups, the first class, which was 1 or 2% of the people, and all the rest, to whom Tacitus referred to as the rabble. But the rabble served a very important role in Roman society. One writer said, the existence of inferiors is an advantage to superiors, since they'll be able to point out those over whom they're superior. Airlines go farther than that, though. There's the 100,000-mile club. There's the executive club. There's the gold club, the silver club, the brick club, the straw club, the just barely a club, and the those of us who don't have a club. And the goal of every level at your airline is to earn enough points to move up into the next level, right? In Jesus' day, the highest level was the 600 senators who ran everything under Caesar. Next came the equestrians, people who were wealthy enough to own their own horses that they could use in battles. Can you imagine taking pride because your mode of transportation is better than someone else's? Huh. Next level down was the decurions. They were the government officials, the religious officials, the city bigwigs. And that was the bottom line for the elite. If you were not in by here, you were not elite. Those people walked on the red carpets. They flew first class. They were the in crowd. Underneath those categories were the 98 percenters, the nobodies, the personas mediocribus, like mediocre people, the not greats. And those people had their own measurements of what constituted success. Some of them were citizens, so they had certain rights and protections. Others were freedmen. They did not have citizenship, but they had personal liberty to do what they wanted. And while certainly not in the elite class, these people had associations of their own to tell who was who. Some associations had higher rankings. Some were less cool. Ortberg says, being the president of the chess club will obviously not get you the dates that being the quarterback of the football team will, but being the alpha dog of the chess club is better than not being the alpha dog at all. At the bottom of the ladder back then were slaves who had to do what other people told them. And even slaves had ladder rungs of their own. Some slaves were voluntary slaves, economic slaves. They had sold themselves in to pay off a debt, while other slaves lived in involuntary slavery because they had been on the losing side of a war. The Romans also used other tricks to let people know who mattered back then and who didn't really matter, like clothing. Clothes were a status symbol in Jesus' day. If you were not a slave, you could wear a freedman's cap. It's a hat that showed you were not on the bottom rung. A male citizen of the Roman Empire could wear a toga virilis when he turned 14. Now, togas were terribly uncomfortable. They were cold in the winter and sticky hot in the summer. They were very impractical. But guys wore togas back then because togas shouted, I am an important person. Can you imagine wearing uncomfortable clothing just to make an impression? It's easy if you try. Senators would wear a toga, but senators got to add a purple stripe. Do you know why Waldo wears stripes? Because he doesn't want to be spotted. Do you know why senators wore stripes? because they did want to be spotted and recognized and honored as senators. Equestrians were not allowed to wear stripes. You could not. If you were not a senator, you couldn't wear one. But equestrians did wear expensive robes and gold rings, which is why their class was sometimes called the Order of the Rings. Do you remember when Jesus' brother warned Christian believers not to favor a visitor that came to their assembly wearing a gold ring and fine clothes over a person who showed up shabbily dressed? James said that because that's what people in their world would do. If you dress nicely, you must be higher up. We would treat you better. You're influential. You're wealthy. You're educated. Please take our best seats. Speaking of which, going to people's parties back then was purely a thing of class, too. If you were not in the right class, you did not get an invitation to the good parties. And once you were at a party, the highest up people got to sit at the head table, and the lower classed people had to sit further back. And the further back in the room you were, the less great you were. That's not how we do it today. In church buildings, the seats in the back are clearly the premier seats. Clearly. But at the Roman theater, seating was not by ticket, it was by class, and the higher you ranked in the world, the closer you were allowed to sit to the stage. Linda and I went to see Shazam last week, but we got to the movie theater a little late, and there were not many seats left. In fact, the only place where there were two together was the front row. And you know, that's very close, but the seats recline, right? So we figured, okay. So we went in and we sat down and we looked up and we laughed. And we walked out. And we found the manager and we said, there's no way. And the guy said, I know. I mean, you're right. I'll get you a refund. Those seats would not have been given to the senators back then because those were not the good seats, even though they were in the very front. Those seats hurt your neck. reminded me of the guy who just got a new job at the guillotine factory. He said, I'll be heading there soon. Speaking of which, even criminality in Rome was a matter of which class you were in. There were one set of laws for the aristocrats, and there were a different set of laws for the rabble. For example, if a Roman citizen was to be executed, it was always by beheading. It was quick. It was merciful. They just ended it. Romans could never be crucified. That was too awful. That was too painful. That was not for citizens. It was reserved for the lowest of low. It was called a punishment for slaves. So according to John Ortberg, when Paul wrote, Paul, a legal citizen of the Roman Empire, when Paul failed to describe himself as a wearer of the toga and instead called himself a slave of the crucified one, that was social suicide. He might as well mark his Facebook status as loser and hope to get any friends. What Christians did, what Jesus taught them to do by his own example, that was inconceivable. And I do know what that word means, and that's exactly what I mean. Inconceivable. In the day when Plutarch wrote a book, a self-help book, which was called How to Praise Yourself Inoffensively, in a world where a book was written called The Achievements of the Divine Augustus, it was written by Augustus. It was a radically new way of looking at what makes someone great when in Mark 10:42, Jesus called them together and said, you know that those who are regarded as rulers of Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them? Not so with you. Jesus said, instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be the slave of all. Did you hear about the guy who found out that his autobiography had just been rejected by publishers for the 42nd time? He just shook his head and said, it's the story of my life. Here's the story of Jesus' life. He was conceived by an unwed mother under questionable circumstances. He was born in a barn. He was dirt poor. His family had to seek asylum in a foreign country as immigrants. He grew up in the sticks. His dad was a construction worker and died young. Jesus had to help his single mom raise a bunch of kids. He never got married. He spent a couple years hanging out with women and children and beggars and the mentally ill. What he said got the authorities so angry that they had him taken out at age 33. And the guys who really seemed to admire Jesus, they were 12 ne'er-do-wells who ran for cover as soon as the going got rough. They abandoned him completely. So when Jesus, a poor commoner was hanging on the cross, naked, punished with a slave's death? By all Roman measurements of what constitutes great, Jesus was not a great man. Nor was Jesus a great man in the eyes of the Jews. Now, it's true, there was that one day that we're celebrating today when it almost seemed like he was. Do you remember Matthew 21 where it says the disciples went and did as Jesus had instructed them? They brought the donkey and the colt and placed their cloaks on them for Jesus to sit on. A very large crowd spread their cloaks on the road, while others cut branches from the trees and spread them on the road. The crowds that went ahead of him and those that followed shouted, "Hosanna to the Son of David! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord! Hosanna in the highest heaven!" When Jesus entered Jerusalem, the whole city was stirred and asked, "Who is this?" And the crowds answered, "This is Jesus, the prophet from Nazareth in Galilee." Right, we all know Palm Sunday, the day his people cheered Jesus like a hero. And on that Sunday, it seemed like the Jewish people were pretty geeked up about this King Jesus guy, yelling, "Wow, is he ever great or what?" Let me tell you why. But first, you guys know that I love the Bills, right? I mean, I cheer for their uniform. No matter who wears it, I keep cheering. What you might not know is that I love the Sabres too. And there's no easy way to say this, but the Sabres stink. And they have been stinking up for a long time, longer than some of you have been alive. They have not made the playoffs in 8 years, currently the longest playoff drought in the NHL. And twice in that period, they've had the worst record in all of hockey. The Sabres are really P.U. stinky. But that was not always so. We had Gilbert Perreault, Rick Martin, Rene Robert, the French Connection. We had Michael Pekka, Rob Roy, Dominic Hasek, probably the greatest goalie in all of hockey history. Oh, those were the days. Such glory. But it's been a very, very long time since then. So, when Jack Eichel came to town, Buffalo put palm branches down on the road in front of him. And when we got Rasmus Dahlin, we started shouting, "Blessed is the one who comes in the name of the Lord," because we thought we were going to be great again. Similarly, Jerusalem had ruled the world when David was king, and they loved being the number one nation in the world. But it had been like 1,000 years since then, literally 1,000 years. And all of those years were like saber years. Really, really sad. But they had this promise from God that one day a guy would show up and everything would change. And even though Jesus didn't do any of the things that the Roman people considered great back then, the stuff he did made the Jews think, this might be our guy. So they cheered and they sang and they danced and they bowed before him and they asked him to kiss their babies and autograph their palms, because one of the clues that God had given them in those 1,000 years of waiting was from Zechariah 9:9, where God said, "Rejoice greatly, daughter of Zion. Shout, daughter of Jerusalem, see your king comes to you, righteous and victorious, lowly and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey." Now, usually back then, kings would ride into cities on big white stallions, victoriously returning from battle. But God said that when his final champion showed up, it would be on a little donkey. And that didn't really make sense to them, but it was easy to spot. Like if God said, "I'm going to send you a very, very special man, and you will be able to recognize him because when all the cars line up for the Daytona 500 one time, my guy will be riding on a John Deere tractor." And the Jew said, "A donkey? A baby donkey? Are you kidding me? That's embarrassing." But God said, "Think what you will. That's how you know it's the right guy." So Jesus has been healing people, sick people. He's been feeding hungry people. He's been canceling storms. And people who have not been in the Stanley Cup Finals for 1,000 years think, he's pretty good. If we were in a war, he could make food out of nothing. And people who get hurt in the war, he could heal them. And if he could change the weather whenever we needed it to change, this guy could make a difference for us. And he seems like a nice enough guy, yeah. He's great. We should make him our king. That's what they were thinking at the triumphal entry. They were thinking, Rome schmoam, we are going to be hosting toga parties pretty soon. And Jesus smiled, and he waved, and he rode into Jerusalem like he was finally going to announce. But a couple days later, Do you remember the end of the story? He let himself be arrested and beaten, and he didn't defend himself. He let himself be mocked. He let them nail him to a cross, and he didn't even struggle. They probably would have fought for him if he would have risen up, but it looked like he was just given up. He let them do all that, and the Jews watched. And they muttered, you know, God's guy, the king we're waiting for, he'd never do that. He would fight. He would win. He wouldn't quit. This is pathetic. This is terrible. And all the Jews went home that Friday afternoon really disappointed. By all Jewish measurements of what constitutes great, Jesus was not a great man. But let's not just do history today. Let's do real life. Let's do today. Who do you think is a great man? Wait, I'm getting a phone call. I can't take that right now. All right, where was I? Who do you think is a great man? If somebody makes a lot of money, do you consider that person great? Are you impressed with that person? If somebody is genius smart, I mean, just the smartest person you've ever met, do you consider that person great? If somebody's really talented, if they're a maestro musician or a published author or an Olympian, if there's an artist who sells paintings, a movie star, an astronaut, a world leader, a really, really good pickleball-playing preacher, do you consider those people great? What makes somebody great in your opinion? If the person is well-known, does that make them great? Do you know the story of Ken and Bob? Two guys who happened to meet one day, and Ken told Bob, as they were talking, he goes, I know everybody. And Bob said, well, maybe you know a lot of people, but you don't know everybody. And Ken said, pretty much, yeah, I know everybody. And Bob said, I bet you don't. So Ken pulled out his phone. Ken pulled out his phone and punched in some numbers, and he waited a minute, and then he said, hey, Tiger, how you doing? Yeah, I'm fine. Yeah. Oh, she's fine, too. Thanks for asking. Yeah, so I'd like you to say hello to a new friend of mine. And he handed the phone to Bob. And Tiger on the phone said, yeah, I know Ken. I know him well. Who doesn't? And Bob hung up the phone. He was impressed, but a little skeptical. He said, you know, that really could have been anybody on the phone. That might not have been Tiger. So they went to D.C. together. Ken and Bob go to the White House, and as they're walking past the Oval Office, President Trump looks out, and he says, hey, Ken, how you doing? And he comes out and talks to him for a while. Bob says, Mr. President, do you actually know Ken? And the president says, sure, everybody knows Ken. And when they leave, Bob said, well, that's kind of cool that you know the president, but you don't know everybody. And Ken said, I'm pretty sure I do. So they fly to Rome, and they're standing in Vatican Square in a mass of people. And the Pope comes out on the balcony, and Ken says, stay right here. And he takes off. A few minutes later, Ken pops out on the balcony, standing there with the Pope. They start talking, hugging, waving together to people. And a guy in the crowd next to Bob taps Bob on the shoulder, and he says, hey, do you know who that man is up there with Ken? America measures greatness by a lot of things. Popularity is certainly high on the list, which is why a lot of Americans today would not consider Jesus great. Because Jesus was kind of judgmental. I mean, he had some troubling ideas about who's going to end up where and why. And Jesus didn't really understand that some behaviors aren't choices, they're just diseases. And Jesus was a little backward on certain lifestyle issues that we're much more tolerant of now. Yeah, Jesus did some good, sure, but he probably shouldn't be considered a great man. Jesus was not a great man, as the Romans define greatness. Jesus was not a great man, as the Jews define greatness. Jesus was not a great man, as many Americans define greatness. But you know who does consider Jesus great? His Father in heaven. At Jesus' baptism, God was so proud of Jesus up to that point, he couldn't help himself. He shouted from heaven, "This is my Son whom I love. I am so pleased with him." And right near the end of Jesus' life on the Mount of Transfiguration, God is again so pleased with Jesus, he blurts out, "This is my Son, my beloved Son. Listen to him." And after his Son endured the cross for us and was buried in the ground, like all of us will be one day, his Father raised him back to life with power. And he gave him all authority in heaven and on earth. And God gave his Son the name that is above all other names. One day, every knee will bow down to that name. Jesus served. He did what his Father wanted done. So God the Father, yeah, he thought Jesus is a great man. That greatest man, greatest ever. You know who else thought Jesus was a great man? The guy dying next to him, who thought Jesus was still somehow going to win, even though it was pretty clear that they were both going to be dead in a couple minutes. But that guy said, hey, Jesus, when you get to where you're going, would you be willing to throw in a good word for me? He thought Jesus could still do something for him, even when he was dying on a cross. Who says that to a guy who's about to be dead unless you think that you're talking to a great man? You know who else thought Jesus was a great man? Peter, Simon Peter, the guy who once told Jesus, I've got your back even if they kill me. And then when Jesus was being killed, Peter was acting like he didn't even know Jesus. There's a verse that says, right as Peter was denying Jesus for the third time, Jesus and Peter's eyes met. Somehow Jesus was in a spot where he could see what Peter was doing. And Peter knew that Jesus knew what he had just done. And Peter's shame was immense. Did you ever do something in life that you still hope nobody ever finds out about? That's how Peter felt. And he knew his secret was safe because Jesus was dead, but it haunted him. And then he found out Jesus wasn't dead, and Peter thought, oh, boy, I almost hope I don't run into him again. But then Jesus met Peter, and he forgave him. And he loved him, again, even more than before. He ate the hurt. He served Peter by forgiving him, which overwhelmed Peter to the point that after that, he did have Jesus' back until it killed him. He kept telling people that Jesus was great until they sentenced Peter to a slave's punishment, at which point Peter said, okay, you can crucify me, but you're going to do it upside down because I am not in my Savior's class. Yeah, Peter thought Jesus was great. You know who else thinks Jesus is great? Corey Cartwright. I met Corey on a missions trip to Panama. Corey Cartwright is from Missouri. He's all Missouri. He talks with a southern drawl. He owns two vehicles, a pickup and another pickup. When I got into his truck to drive it up into the village in the mountains one day, I turned on and a song that came blasting out was so country western twang, I immediately killed the engine until I could find out how to get a different radio station, only to discover it was a CD. Corey is all Missouri. He likes to go limb lining. Have you heard of limb lining? It's where you bend tree branches down over a river and you bait large hooks with 6-inch perch and you leave them hanging half in the water so that something big will come by and grab it. And when it does, the branch springs up and you see fish hanging in a bunch of trees along the river line when you walk back to get them. Limb lining, you know. Corey tells about checking his traps one day and he found a 3-foot gar hanging there. But when he went to cut it down, it wasn't quite as dead as he thought, and it twisted and spun, and it ended up with the hook going through Corey's forearm and out the back. His dad came to help him, but he couldn't get the fish or the hook loose, so they cut off the limb and took the whole mess to a local hospital, where the doc used pliers to remove the hook. But it was in so deep, he bent the pliers, getting the hook out. And Corey kept the bent pliers as a souvenir. I'll tell you what, he's a Missouri boy. I'll tell you what is how Corey ends every sentence when he's satisfied with a conversation. He always says, I'll tell you what. But I know very few people as passionate to use the gifts God's given them to help people live better now and to end up in heaven later than Corey Cartwright. He builds ponds. He teaches Panamanians how to grow fish to feed their families and to sell to others. And when villages go from having no food or money to raising tilapia and shrimp, they are very grateful for Corey. And then Corey tells them about the bread of life that when they eat will allow them to live forever. He is a good, good, good guy, even if he does cheer for the St. Louis Cardinals. One day, I asked Corey who taught him how to live and think and love people like he does. And Corey talked about his parents for a while, and he talked about some people in his church that he grew up with. Then he talked about Roy Weiss. Mr. Weiss was Corey's campus minister when he went to college in Missouri. Corey said, He'd walk into the campus ministry office every morning and he'd say, "What's a good word, Roy?" And Corey said Mr. Weiss would always pause what he was doing and look up at the ceiling for a minute. And then he'd say, "Jesus saves and satisfies." Every day, "What's a good word, Roy?" Every day, Mr. Weiss would pause and he'd say, "Jesus saves and he satisfies." After a couple months of that, every day, Corey said, "Hey, Roy, you always answer me the same way every time I ask what's a good word for today, but you always pause first. Why do you do that?" And Mr. Weiss said, "Well, Corey, every time you ask that question, I have to stop and see if I think it's still true. And every day I realize it is. It's still true. Jesus saves and satisfies." Roy Weiss thinks Jesus is a great man because he saves and satisfies. He serves us. Corey Cartwright thinks Jesus is a great man because Jesus saves and satisfies. He serves us. I think Jesus is a great man because he saves and satisfies me. He serves me. He serves me. How bizarre is that? Here's the good word for you today. Folks, Jesus saves and satisfies. To finish today's sermon, I want to invite you to sing a song that we just heard. We're going to sing the song that Gina introduced us to honor a great man.